Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened the credit and burned that. Man, the way that I live don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened the credit and burned that. Man, the way that I live don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, moving to it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, moving to it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, up made me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness. Ever since the Declaration of Independence, we've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years, they affected us. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News on this 26th day of October in the year 2012. I'm your host, Solomon, but today we have an extremely special episode, and it's, an exclusive episode, because throughout the rest of the show, for the next hour and a few minutes, some comrades of mine are going to be joining me online, and we're going to be discussing the unveiling of an extremely special organization that we've been diligently working on for the past year. And that organization is known as the Pan-African Collective for Advocacy and Action, otherwise known as the PACAA. And it's a name and an acronym that we believe that our listeners and folks well beyond our listenership, you know, throughout what's commonly known as the United States of America and the globe, and especially African people the globe over, we intend on our name, the name of this organization, being something that is synonymous with advocacy and action when it comes to the solidarity and work on behalf of African people the globe over, as well as our allies. And so joining me in about a couple moments will be Benjamin Woods, who is a good friend of mine. I'm happy to call him a good friend of mine, and even more thrilled to call him a comrade. And Benjamin Woods is one of the co-founders of an organization by the name of SAMI, Students Against Mass Incarceration. He's also a PhD candidate at Howard University, and he's one of the founding members of the PACAA, Pan-African Collective for Advocacy and Action. And also joining me online is a gentleman that I refer to as a brother of mine, and that is Obi Egbuna, who is a comrade of mine and who is also one of the founding members of PACAA. And Obi's work really precedes himself. You know, he's worked everywhere from El Salvador to Colombia, you know, working with Africans in Colombia around Plan Colombia. He's the U.S. correspondent for the Zimbabwe Herald, and that is Zimbabwe's national newspaper. It is the newspaper of record in Zimbabwe, and he'll be joining us online. And he's, as I said before, he's also a founding member of the PACAA. So we want to take this opportunity to explain to you what the PACAA is and the roles that we'll be playing within this organization, the different experiences and talent sets or skill sets that we bring to this organization, and how each of us sees this organization within the framework of trying to be on that revolutionary path and trying to help, you know, our community as best we can, and how to collaborate and to serve as a support organization. And also, you know, some of the work that we'll be doing, we'll be writing white papers, so-called white papers, policy-driven papers, and having various press conferences to unleash these policy-driven papers and the work. And one of the things that also we'll be discussing, and Obi will probably be discussing this, is the recent appeal that was spearheaded by himself and some other folks. And PACAA is happy to embrace this appeal, an appeal to the President of the United States of America, Barack Hussein Obama, and it's an appeal that is centered around Cuba. And I'll let Obi, you know, break that down, you know, when he comes on. So without further ado, I'd like to bring them on, and I want to let folks know, if you want to get more information about PACAA, you can go to thepacaa.org. So www.thepacaa.org. That's thepacaa.org, and that's where you can find more information about our mission. We have our think tank, the resources, the policy papers, our approach to education, arts and culture, why we put a significant emphasis on arts and culture, educational initiatives. We also have a blog. We'll be updating news and information, including the appeal that's going to be has been released. It can all be found on thepacaa.org. So without further ado, I'd like to bring on right now Obi Egbuna and Benjamin Woods. Gentlemen, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you good. I can hear you good. This is Ben here. Glad to be on.
Okay. And I was totally remiss because I didn't see on the line, but I also see our other comrade who actually deserves to get a lot of the credit for spearheading this, and that's Dr. Joseph Richardson, who is a professor in who focuses on mass incarceration and carceral studies, and one of the only professors I know in America that really puts a significant amount of his work into the criminal justice system that is anti, you know, doesn't see the building of prisons and mass incarceration as a good thing. But also places a lot in it, of his work on youth justice and things surrounding that. So I think he's on the line. Dr. Richardson, Joe, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. Well, Joe, I think since we have you and Ben on, and Obi will be calling in a few moments, Joe, can you kind of like get us going, because it was about a little over a year ago that, you know, you really, you know, brought this idea to myself and said, you know what, you know, why don't we start an organization that's framed like this? And I thought it was an excellent idea, but, you know, the genesis of it really came from, you know, from your mind. Can you kind of tell our listeners and our viewers what, you know, what you see the PACAA as and why?
Sure, definitely. I just want to, again, thank you, brothers, for all coming together, all my comrades, for this initiative and effort. But the reason why I thought of it, the idea, I thought it was necessary, primarily comes from my own personal and professional experiences working at several policy think tanks in Washington, D.C., as well as in New York City, and seeing the need for a more progressive think tank that addresses issues which those think tanks would kind of shy away from those issues. And I think the issues that we really need to be addressed and heard were not coming out of the policy discussions and the white papers that were being produced by those think tanks. And I won't say any names because I'm not here to indict any other think tank for their ideology or philosophical mission. But I think that there's a huge void in the voices that are coming from the grassroots level that need to be heard, but particularly through a vehicle and mechanism that could be used to affect and change policy, but not coming from the typical think tank that we typically have seen on the American public policy landscape. So I think this is an appropriate time, and I mean, there's no better time than the present, than to establish a more progressive, forward-thinking think tank that's able to address a multitude of issues, both domestically and internationally. And we have a wide array and very articulate brothers who have already been doing their work in that area, so it just seemed to make natural sense to bring all of us together collectively to do the work that we were already doing in our professional lives as well. So I think that we're at a position and a juncture in U.S. relations with other countries, as well as the policies that we find to be draconian in the U.S. right now, particularly kind of mass incarceration policies, social justice, welfare, economic and environmental policies that disproportionately affect people of color, particularly poor people of color. And that affects us worldwide. And this would be, I believe, an institution that would sustain itself beyond the members who just started it, but I envision it being an institution that will be able to have an impact globally far beyond the members that started it. And hopefully, you know, somewhere 10, 5, 15, 25 years down the line, we'll be able to look back at this moment and say we've really come a long way and addressed all of those goals we expected to address and more.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks, Dr. Richardson. Ben, can you you know, tell us why you decided to get involved in this? Because you know you're part of a very very strong organization which PACAA fully supports and looks forward to embracing and supporting the work of Sammy as best we can and as much as we can. But you know, you're familiar with the history of African organizations that have truly been founded and sustained by Africans, and you know the history. So why did you see a significant opening and you know and promise and I would say I guess a very auspicious you know look at the PACC or PACAA, why did you decide to get involved?
First, you know, thank you for having me on. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be a part of really this organization. You would asking me to be a part of this. I think this really is monumental and really possibly historic what we're doing here, because I think you really mentioned it when you were talking a moment ago, Solomon, that what's important is we look at like this election time now and everybody's going for, we see so many black people getting caught up within the election and the Democratic Party and this corporate two-party system, is that what we really need for black folk is really independent organizations. You know, ones where we can have, you know, conversations on our own, discussions, you know, with this organization, gather data, provide an analysis, you know, and really connect with a network of organizations that we're all connected to. You know, in the name it says it, advocacy and action. And I think that's the power of it. We're going to be, you know, we're all people, brothers who do research in different areas, some overlapping with the prisons, labor, some in Africa, different regions of it. And I think it's just we can add more on to it. And that, I think that's one of the powers of it, just to have an independent organization and we can present an analysis. Because right now, like you mentioned, the prison issue, which is with students against mass incarceration, something we have to look to. We oftentimes have to read, you know, information has to come from the ACE, you know, while I want to say, he almost said, didn't say names, but really the ACLU or some other organizations or the American Amnesty International that may not present, like he said, on certain issues or even the tilt of where they're coming from, you know, maybe a more, quite frankly, liberal kind of civil rights reformist posture. And I think this is something we can offer a more independent analysis from a, you know, openly, certainly black perspective, you know, which is really squarely missing right now. And I think also the power of this is that it's international, you know, the Pan-African, because, you know, oftentimes black people are forced, you know, the leadership is forced more and more to look at the world from a very you know, U.S. nation-state-centric kind of perspective, as though that's all the world is. There's nothing outside of the United States. It's the center of the universe. And more, that's really not true. It never really was. But as though there aren't black people, you know, outside of America. You know, there's millions just in countries like Brazil, Colombia, and other places around the world alone. So I think this is an opportunity for us to really, I think, do something monumental, historic, similar organizations. You know, when we look at it international, I think people like Martin Luther King, a part of his life towards the end, when he really became more, really always was, but became even more of an internationalist explicitly, is when you saw a real power to his analysis of when he became a threat. Or you look at other organizations that have come in the past, you know, such as the Council on African Affairs.
That's right.
So many people like Du Bois, some of the great intellectuals, Robeson, and, you know, someone at Howard, Alpheus Hunton, a former alumnus and a professor at Howard. You know, you see so many people that have come. It's the role of just internationalism, you know, black people is important in our struggle and really help us to connect our struggles to other people. So I think that's the power of it.
That's right. That's right. I appreciate that. And you know, so I think it's a perfect segue since you mentioned the internationalist component, you know, to bring in, you know, the fourth founder of PACAA, and that's Obi Egbuna, who, as I said before, you know, when we led off the show, was instrumental in putting together the appeal. And I won't, you know, go into in depth that. I'll let him explain that, you know, sometime during this show. But that's something that the PACAA fully embraces and has gone ahead and gladly posted that on our blog section of our website. But that represents our internationalism with our comrades in Cuba, you know, and it's really important to understand that if it wasn't the internationalism that came from, you know, the likes of the Cubans, you know, such as Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and so many others, and most of those soldiers that went into the continent to fight and help liberate Southern Africa and as well as Algeria, you know, were African Cubans. And so, Obi, can you hear me? Are you on?
Yes, I'm on.
I'd just like to ask you the same, you know, preliminary question that I asked Joe and Ben, and that's, why did you decide to get involved in the PACAA? Why did you see an opening in this organization? Why did you see promise in this organization? and why did you want to get involved in it?
Well, obviously because I felt that amongst the founding members, we would have excellent working chemistry. That's the first thing, because anytime an organization seeks to maximize its potential as it pertains to achieving its short-term and long-term objectives, the working chemistry between the members is a very crucial ingredient. And right here, I feel extremely comfortable. Also, taking a look at the historical space that we occupy, I like to look at this era of history as us making, we've gone from COINTELPRO imperialism. Our former colonial and slave masters have gone from COINTELPRO to OINTELPRO. This is the era of overt intelligence. As we know, what the covert intelligence program did, this is the era of overt intelligence. We're well aware of the bloody trail of the FBI, the bloody trail of the CIA, the bloody trail of the U.S. military, and the U.S. Military imperial apparatus, for that matter. But at this moment, because of organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy, Ronald Reagan's contribution to think tanks, because of organizations like the United States Agency for International Development, the National Democratic Institute, where Madeleine Albright today does her best impersonation of the eagle as the wings flap and she flies and terror creates an atmosphere and climate for terror all over the world, we recognize that Africans must have an organization that has this type of scope, this type of focus, and this type of perspective that enables us to defend, but also enables us to go on the offensive. And what I mean by going on the offensive is when we look at how our history is interpreted so much, some of the analytical framework that many people use is steeped in victimhood. If people focus on chattel slavery, they'll focus on the 400 years of force-free labor. They'll focus on how we were brutalized, how our women were raped, how we were tortured, how we were kidnapped, how we were abducted, how colonialism made us slaves on our own mother continent. Portuguese shoved down our throats. English shoved down our throats. Germans shoved down our throats. But they don't focus on the anti-colonial movement. They don't focus on slave rebellions from Cuba to the Dominican Republic to Haiti to right here in the United States. So it's very important to show our people that no matter what obstacles we've encountered because of colonialism and slavery, we have always emerged victorious. We have won many battles as we continue to organize, and our aim is to win the ultimate war. Of course, also, as those who spoke before me talked about as well, our people have accepted that voting is the only outlet of political expression. If we say that voting is the most effective outlet of political expression, then that's something that we can intelligently and objectively discuss. But when we say it's the only outlet of expression, that means that by that statement, embracing a sentiment of that sort, we are saying that all the grassroots organized formations that we have created on this front line of genuine resistance, that none of them were worthy of our attention. And moving into the future, we are willing to abandon the method of resistance that, historically speaking, has always resulted in victory, short-term victory and long-term victory. So whether we're looking at, and at also lastly, we're also dealing with making a quantum leap in our outlook of things, where many people are tired of a perspective. You would think that our resistance began in the 1960s and it ended in the 1960s. I'm inclined to believe that we're going to have to start telling our modern history the way the Bible is read, where you deal with the Old Testament, New Testament, and everything is discussed in AC and BC. We're going to have to break down modern African history into three categories, BMLK, DMLK, and AMLK, before Martin Luther King, during Martin Luther King, and after Martin Luther King. so that we recognize that we must break this cycle of making it seem like the 60s was the only period that we were able to persevere, the only period of our history where we depended on each other and we let our resiliency drive us to many monumental victories. So we have to shatter that. And, of course, this whole cycle of political domestication where many people are scared to look beyond the United States, even the way we talk about the Americas, we submit to the definition of the Democrats and Republicans making the fascist proclamation that they are America, a statement so fascist that it would make even Hitler and Mussolini envious and what have you. So looking to Africans throughout the Americas, looking to Africans in Australia, where we've been for 80,000 years, looking to Africans in India, where there are 160 million of us, and having practical, tangible things that we can work on so that we can take our resistance to new unprecedented heights.
Thank you, Obi. Thank you. Joe, I want to start with you in this next question. None of us would consider ourselves so-called one-trick ponies, but in terms of the specific, one of the specific or some of the specific areas of concentration that we all focus on, I'd like to start with you, Joe, if you can kind of elaborate on, you know, the specific areas of concentration that you bring to the table with PACAA and why you think it's an important area of concentration that this organization focuses on.
Okay, well, primarily, and for warranted reasons, and I mean, we have so many other brothers that are part of this organization that are vested and believe in this work, but one of my primary focal areas is the prison industrial complex. And we know that right now the U.S. has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of all the people who are incarcerated in the world are in the United States. Right now we have over 7 million people who are under some form of criminal justice supervision, which means they're either in jail, on parole or probation, or under some form of house arrest. And that's disproportionately people who are black and brown and who are poor. So I think knowing that we now live in an era where prison is and has been the new form of slavery and is legitimized in the 13th Amendment, I think one of the goals for our organization is to, A, address the prison industrial complex and prison for profit, where we now have corporations who are making billions of dollars from the incarceration of people who are black and brown in this country, and also to address the legislative laws, which are totally have been draconian, which have brought millions of people under the criminal justice supervision. So if you think about some of the laws that most people who probably are blindly going to vote for Barack Obama and have no idea about his record on criminal justice and typically don't understand where Barack Obama stands policy-wise in his administration on criminal justice issues, I think it's imperative for us to shed light on those policies which have disproportionately impacted black people. And we can go into that conversation later on in the discussion if we want to elaborate on that a little bit further. But I think it's important at this juncture where we are right now is to clearly address what's problematic about the criminal justice system and where the criminal justice system stands in the intersection of public and private interests. But I also think that it's important, and my work expands beyond the criminal justice system, but also focuses on violence among young African-American men. And we know that in cities such as Chicago and my hometown of Philadelphia, that young black men are killing each other at an alarming rate. I mean, in Chicago right now, there have been, I think, estimated 420 murders in the city as of October, and in Philadelphia we're heading for 300 murders. So my main question is how does a young boy the age of 14 and 15 years old, beyond the issues that we need to confront why we're engaging in violence and the structural violence which ultimately leads to direct violence among these young brothers, such as dysfunctional schools, police brutality, prison industrial complex, et cetera. But I'm also very interested in focusing on how we're managing to address the laws which push most of the automatic weapons that we see on the street right now. I was recently watching something, actually today, on Chicago, and that Chicago every year there are 10,000 guns collected by the police department. Now, if you think in one city there could be 10,000 guns, but yet there's still 420 murders, something has to be going on where it doesn't really matter how many guns the police department confiscates because it's all smoke and mirrors. So when we see things, we see issues such as the Fast and Furious, and we think that's just an isolated incident where the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms has been engaged in the distribution of guns in Mexico and along the U.S. border, I don't see it as such. In the same way I didn't see it as an isolated incident, some people probably would have thought it was crazy when initially the story was broke that the CIA was involved in the illegal distribution of drugs throughout the United States. So another issue that I'm very interested in is how do these guns manage to make it into the hands of a 14- or 15-year-old black child that lives in the inner city that ultimately may end up turning that gun on the same person who looks like himself. So those two issues for me are critical as part of this group. But I also, Ben had mentioned the issue of, and I don't want to be remiss about not focusing on this. There's one part of our think tank which focuses on policy, but most think tanks, what differentiates us from all other think tanks that I've ever seen or had the opportunity to work with, has been the advocacy component, because think tanks typically stop at the policy analysis side. They are not going to be engaged in the activism and advocacy side, and that's for a reason. Why? Because if they began to really address the problems, there would be no reason to have a think tank, because that the money that they're making from typically pimping the system on grants and other ways, incentives that they have to keep those think tanks going, would come to an end. But I think ultimately we have a personal invested interest in seeing these problems that we're dealing with ultimately disappear off the landscape, hopefully. So I just want to make sure that, you know, people are aware that the primary components that we have as part of this policy think tank is not only to just address policy issues, but also to find ways to engage in the activism and advocacy to ameliorate the problems that we are exploring and addressing.
Thank you, Joe. And before we move to Ben, I just want to, I just guess I'll just kind of sneak myself in there. And one of the areas that I, you know, the areas of interest and concentration that I bring to PACAA is a concentration of media and communications as well as culture. But, you know, I see it being vastly important for us to have, as Ben alluded to earlier, that, you know, the importance of having independent black organizations that are, you know, independent, that are completely vertical when it comes to Africans, you know, founding and controlling these organizations. I believe the same thing when it comes to our mediums and our communication. And it's we don't need, I mean, we should have learned our lesson not to have to genuflect and to rely on the so-called white corporate liberal media. I know I was being redundant in all of that, you know, saying white corporate, you know, liberal media to reinforce, or not even to reinforce, but to carry our messages, because they don't carry our messages. They dilute them, they obfuscate them, they marginalize them, they create them to their own to their own interests. And those folks that are routinely on, and I don't have to mention any names, but those folks that are routinely invited and provided platforms that look like that are of African ancestry, that find themselves on these airwaves, whether it's MSNBC or CNN or the like, you know, the messages that come from them, they're basically puppets, they're parrots, they're parroting what their white editors or white executive producers want them to say, and they know very well that there's not much lateral movement for them to negotiate any kind of perspective, any kind of honest perspective commentary, analysis when it comes to any issue that affects African people, not just within the stolen borders of the United States of America, but globally, and especially, and also, I should say, when it comes to negotiating any kind of commentary or honest analysis when it comes to people that we see as our allies, such as the Palestinians. And so having Your World News, which is going to serve as the official media arm, the official media wing of the PACAA, is vastly important. And so that's an area of concentration that I will be, working on diligently and making sure that, I continue to develop deep inroads with other mediums, especially African mediums that are aligned, that we see some kind of alignment, in terms of different things that our mission touches on. But also, I should mention also Obi will be, playing a role in this as well, because he serves as the U.S. correspondent for the Zimbabwe Herald, and his long track record, not just in Zimbabwe, but within different places throughout the world, is going to play a significant role in culture, utilizing, our culture that we've created, cultural artifacts and cultural mediums such as hip-hop culture, which is a culture, and utilizing, rap music within that culture, as well as the other elements that make up hip-hop culture, using my experience and my track record as a hip-hop historian, as a hip-hop-inspired so-called activist, using that as a tool to tap into the youth and organizing and working with the youth and bringing, as Obi alluded, that missing element of honest historical information and commentary and analysis, but to the youth, as well as as well as working with them. Hip hop can be used as a very powerful tool, and it has been used historically, but that way. But as we see now, when it's left into the hands of white folks and their the faces of color that serve as their puppets, it's used as a tool, quite frankly, against the best interests of our community and the most precious jewels within our community, and that's the youth. And so that's those are a couple of the areas of concentration that I, Solomon Kamajan, will be lending my every ounce of my fiber into the PACAA with. Ben, can you jump on that?
It's time. Yeah, definitely. I mean, all that is true. I just want to sort of add, I think, somewhat to Dr. Richardson. I mean, our interests in some ways overlap. Me working with students against mass incarceration, one of the major issues that he mentioned that it's important is that 13th Amendment and the fact that it says that involuntary servitude is abolished except in cases of punishment for a crime. So you can actually, Jackie said, slavery is still legal. You can even see it in so many cases, like here, and I'm in Washington, D.C. You have a Corrections Corporations of America prison, a prison that's privately managed, right? It's sold on the stock exchange, and people are making huge, like this is a multi-billion-dollar industry. When you say the prison industrial complex, it's an industry, it's a for-profit industry. And I think there was a report released showing, or the ACLU showing, that the two largest private prison management corporations in 2010 had over $3 billion in revenue. That's with a B, almost $3 billion in revenue. And that's just two corporations. That's not to mention the cheap labor and all this. So this is a huge industry that's affecting our people. Another thing that really interests me in terms of putting out more positions and policies on and an analysis and mobilizing, not just more liberal reformist type groups, are is around the issue of stop and frisk. In D.C., they're called jump outs. The police will jump out on you, depends on where you're at. But the policy, it's the same policy. In New York City alone, last year they said, I think it was 600,000 people were stopped and frisked, and over 80%, 85% of them were black and Latino. And that's who's being targeted, and that's one of the beginner points where they're catching, even though, you know, on the other side of town, this white guy may have, he may or may not have any drugs on him. But if you're consistently stopping and targeting this group, and you know, that's who you're going to catch, and that's where you're going to go. I think these are just some of the, these are some of the issues, you know, interested in. Also, more recently within the world, I think one of mine that I'm particularly focused on in my research as you said, a PhD student, is in labor. And more recently, we're seeing an intensification as the objective conditions of the world and just the economic conditions get so dire, and the United States attempts to impose these austerity measures. You're seeing more of a pushback from labor in different parts of the world, particularly even in the United States, where in Chicago, the Chicago Teachers Union was organizing and went on strike recently, led by a black woman. And I think that's something key, one of the leadership, as well as recently, Walmart is even being organized in places like in Arkansas. They actually went to the headquarters of Walmart. Walmart workers did and had a rally. Exactly, as well as in as part of the supply side chain of Walmart in places like California and Illinois are organizing as well. And these jobs are located, going to be working class, are going to be, you know, black people disproportionately because we're working class people. So that's something that we, you know, have to really much more get into is labor, especially on the level of Pan-Africanists involve themselves in the labor struggles. Even internationally, more recently, I think Obi could speak to it as well, he will, is the Marikana mines in South Africa. You know, these black workers and the contradictions within, across, really you see it in South Africa, especially more recently, but around the globe of really neo-colonialism, you know, those contradictions there between workers and the black elite. You know, you see it in any city, we'll see it. So, I mean, these are some of the issues to really, I think we'd have to be highlighted and really organized around. Because I think, as everyone's mentioning, that we find so important is really providing an analysis theory and practice that we actually have a network of organizations and institutions we're all connected to that we can disseminate this information and really mobilize the masses of our people around. And I think that's what makes this so powerful. Is the theory and practice is that we can get the information out, we can get the information collected and it out to our people and different organizations, and those organizers and activists that can do the work.
That's right, and especially with, you know, 3.4% of all the radio stations and 0.6% of all the full power television stations in the U.S., you know, being controlled and owned and operated by African people, by black people. Ben, you highlight a vastly important aspect of our organization, you know, and that's using this organization and its media wing to disseminate that vastly important information. Obi, can you bless us with the same question, with a response to the same question?
Most definitely I can. In terms of what all of us bring to the table, obviously anyone listening in can listen to the diverse mix of experience that we have. And that's always an important ingredient. Whenever you start an organization, you look at the will of the people who created, the skill of the people who created, and obviously their talents, because that's what they bring to the table, and their experience. But our individual experience is for the benefit of our collective experience, the collective experience of Africans in 125 countries all over the world, obviously. So I think that one of the things that we are going to have the opportunity to focus on is, first of all, when we talk about white liberals, there's a reason that all of us are putting emphasis on that, is because there's this illusion in this country that there's a white left. There's no white left in this country. There are white liberals who lean to the left when it's convenient for them to do so. In the same vein that we feel that it's becoming difficult to say that we have a civil rights movement anymore, what we have is the democratic machine in our community, where many people who at one point were in the civil rights movement have decided that it's strategically advantageous to throw all of their weight and all of their energy to be the bottom pillar of the democratic machine. So with that being said, that creates a vacuum and it creates an atmosphere for us to deal with what many people are coming to the conclusion is the era of strategic and tactical bankruptcy. Our ability to come up with new creative ideas, campaigns, and initiatives where those ideas are rooted. So, for example, when we deal with one of the areas where white liberals have created so much confusion, when they deal with military repression and violence, they still are focusing on traditional warfare, guns, bombs, warplanes. And it sends a statement, it propagates the notion that only when this type of activity is taking place, that's the only time that the military aspect of U.S. foreign policy should be dealt with. However, we have seen since the beginning of the 20th century, clearer than ever, that sanctioning by our former colonial and slave masters is the most dangerous genocidal instrument that imperialist forces have at their disposal. And when we're dealing with Cuba, and since we are 97% Democrat, it is only justice that we challenge the Democratic Party. We lock horns with the Democratic Party to lift the blockade on Cuba that Kennedy imposed on Cuba after the Bay of Pigs invasion failed. It also, and of course, so off the continent of Africa, that is an issue that has Pan-African and international potential. And since the whole world, over 180 countries, vote religiously at the United Nations every year for that policy to be lifted, what that illustrates is inside United States borders, our efforts to see that rectified are at best casual, And that, and when we take a look at all the Africans who have traveled to Cuba since 1959 to show their appreciation for the Cuban Revolution, it's glaringly obvious that something is not being done. So we need to put more energy, more effort into getting that policy dealt with. And, of course, in the case of Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act of 2001 is now in its 11th year as a policy. These are sanctions on Zimbabwe that were a vindictive response to seeing Zimbabwe reclaim 12 million hectares of land to give back to indigenous Africans in Zimbabwe, land that had not been in their possession since 1890 when Britain and Rhodesia invaded that country, when Cecil John Rhodes and the British South African Company invaded that country, and giving the United States government and Britain 20 years to honor the Lancaster House agreements, when it was politically in vogue and fashionable to get locked up in front of the South African embassy during the 80s, we did nothing to pressure the U.S. government to honor the Lancaster House agreement. And then when they finally took the land back, our land back, reclaimed our land, and sanctions were a vindictive measure for that, and also Operation Sovereign Legitimacy, where Zimbabwe's military, Angola's military, and Namibia's military defended the Congo and prevented the United States and others from reestablishing the domination on the ground in the Congo and enjoying the political comfort they had enjoyed since the brutal and cowardly CIA-driven assassination of Patrice Lumumba 51 years ago. And when Mobutu Seseko, the godfather of military neocolonialism, and his reign of terror from that moment to the late 1990s, Zimbabwe tried to set them on the course of independence and has been punished for it. And even though the non-aligned movement, over 100 countries, are calling for the lifting of these sanctions, even as the Southern African Development Community, 14 countries representing the southern region of Africa, Africa's most stable region at this moment in history, have called for the lifting of these sanctions. The African Union, many people consider them a paper tiger, but the one of the only issues they have stood courageously strong on is the lifting of these sanctions against Zimbabwe. Every now and then there's a loose cannon, like Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in Liberia, who the biggest supporter of AFRICOM in terms of African heads of states, Blaise Compaoré, the murderer of Thomas Sankara, as this year marks the 25th anniversary of our fallen warrior Thomas Sankara, killed by Blaise Compaoré, his so-called best friend. He called for maintaining these sanctions against Zimbabwe, and Tsiritsi Khama, the president, Ian Khama, the president of Botswana, who said that if the U.S. and European Union considered invading Zimbabwe, they could use Botswana as space, only to be chastised by all of Southern Africa that he was out of order when he made that statement. So the time has come for us to do everything we can to get those sanctions lifted, sanctions that have cost Cuba nearly $100 billion since 1959, money that could go towards the free education, money that could go towards the free health care, money that could go towards upgrading the 85% of the property that the citizens of that country own outright. And in the case of Zimbabwe, this is a declaration of war, these sanctions, on a country that has a 97% literacy rate, at a country that has had the most significant decline in HIV/AIDS cases in the region of Africa where the pandemic and scourge is most prevalent. So we want to put more attention on getting these sanctions lifted on Zimbabwe and getting the blockade lifted on Cuba and forcing people who have been casual about this in our community, only really bringing attention to those places when they're on the verge of traveling to those countries and right when they come back from traveling from those countries. These are the only times they really mention these issues, meaning that they're only interested in making splashes but have no interest in making waves and breakthroughs. And we in PACAA are about waves and breakthroughs. So those are two areas on the Pan-African scale that we're going to be heavily invested in. In terms of Cuba, I just finished something as a contribution to this area in my capacity as the U.S. correspondent to The Herald, Zimbabwe's national newspaper. I have the honor of being the first one in the history of that country to have that responsibility. It's not a title, it's not an accolade, it's a responsibility. And as we begin to focus more on historical responsibility and not be preoccupied with leadership, where in this country all African leadership is a picture in Ebony magazine the same size of a mugshot if the police incarcerates you. So that doesn't mean a damn thing. So we're focusing on historical responsibility. So in that instance, we drafted two appeals. I had the honor of working very closely on this with Mutulu Olubala, known to others as M1, of the internationally acclaimed hip-hop group Dead Prez. Mukasa Dada, formerly known as Willie Ricks, the head field marshal of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a distinguished SNCC alum. His son, Abeku Dada, who is the founder of the Organization of African Doctors, which is an organization that was created at the Latin American School of Medical Sciences in Cuba of all the students of African ancestry who are down there studying medicine, whether they were born on the continent or off the continent, and the American Indian Movement out of Minneapolis, Minnesota, who I've had the honor and privilege of working with since 1991. So we crafted two appeals with Cuba as the backdrop. The first one was an appeal to U.S. President Barack Obama, as many people consider Obamacare, as it is called, their point of reference to dealing with the issue of health care. But we know that it begins with us in 1896 when the Africans who established the National Medical Association, because we could not join the American Medical Association, our struggle starts there. We also pay tribute with this effort to W.E.B. Du Bois when he wrote the journal called The Health and Physique of the Negro American in 1906, where he was showing that our relationship to health care had not changed from chattel slavery to 1906, and of course to Booker T. Washington for establishing Negro Health Month. What we're demanding is that President Obama, the U.S. Congress, and the U.S. Senate allow Cuban doctors to come three places inside U.S. borders: to Native American reservations, to prison infirmaries, and to communities that have had public hospitals and clinics shut down. Simultaneously, an appeal has gone to the African Union, and we are saying to them that at a moment where we have 21 million HIV/AIDS orphans on the African continent alone, what we would like to see is all 55 African nations establish a joint fund that would bring back to Africa the 4,000-member HIV-AIDS brigade that Cuba offered to send to Africa 12 years ago as their contribution to the Millennium Fund, since we know that Cuba has the lowest HIV-AIDS rate in the world. So those are the things that we've worked on to show people the other attributes of the Cuban Revolution. And having the opportunity to have spent 16 months in Zimbabwe since 2006, and I'm a member also of the Zimbabwe-Cuban Friendship Association. I'm the only U.S.-based member that's a member of that. I've seen the Cuban Medical Brigade in action on the African continent and watched them go to places that the indigenous people, doctors don't even go. And also, when they're not treating people in the fields, what they're doing is teaching in the medical schools in their humble attempt to reverse the brain drain in Africa, where our best doctors work in the countries of their former colonial and slave masters, not with their people where they're needed the most. So we're going to be working in that area. We're on the verge of starting next year a project called Merging Our Experiences. It's an educational project where the goal of that project is to make this the last time in our history that we discuss slavery and colonialism as separate episodes of our history. And what that enables us to do, once again, is to look at the slavery of Africans in the Americas, not just exclusively dealing with the slavery in Alabama or Mississippi or Virginia or Maryland, but focusing on slavery in Cuba, slavery in the Dominican Republic, slavery in Haiti, because we consider the slave ship the first form of public transportation when you look at all the stops it made. It made stops just like the subway does. It made stops just like the buses do. And they dropped us off, and that is why our blood and our sweat and our force-free labor, stains of it are all over this hemisphere. So we're going to be focused on that. And through that instrument, we're hoping to make sure that this generation and future generations no longer look at what goes on in Africa as foreign policy. Because the way we've been taught about Africa in the school system, we've learned more about Uranus and Jupiter and Saturn and Pluto and Neptune and the sun. We've learned more about other parts of the solar system than we've learned about Mother Africa. And we feel that by merging the experiences of colonialism and slavery, we'll be able to put a stop to this, and we'll be able to be more aggressive in challenging our former colonial and slave masters in the countries where their policies towards Africa are still genocidal, still ruthless, still bloodthirsty, and still an endangerment to the human species in those places. And lastly, I just, with some parents, established a theater company earlier this summer called Mass Emphasis. It's a children's history, African children's history and theater company, where we seek to use theater as an instrument to infuse our history in a more aggressive but receptive manner. And we've done 4 plays in a year. Our first play was called African Liberation Day for Our Children, which we did last year in the Washington, D.C. area, and we did it in Selma and Tuskegee down south with 2 groups of children. Our second play was Cuba's Greatest Army, a tribute to the Cuban doctors, where the first part of the play focused on many of the African revolutionaries who have special ties to Cuba, so everybody from Masada Shakur to Antonio Maceo, who was the leader of the armed struggle in what is called in history the Spanish-American War, which was the first aggressive fight by the Africans in Cuba to stop the annexation of Cuba, because many people believe that, and we go from Antonio Maceo to Thomas Sankara, the first recipient of the Jose Marti Award, to Robert Mugabe, to Samora Machel, who died on his plane with 2 Cuban doctors, to Frantz Fanon, so we gave to Josephine Baker, for that matter. And then after we dealt with the historical figures, we focused on the Cuban doctors and the work they do all over the African world, all over the Caribbean, and in other places where other people have been colonized and enslaved. Our third play was Sally Mugabe Lives Forever, which was a tribute to Amai Sally Mugabe, Zimbabwe's first lady, as this year marks the 20th anniversary of her passing. And then the next play we did was called The War in the Classroom, which was a tribute to many of the Africans in the field of education, people like Nannie Helen Burroughs, Sterling Brown, the great poet, Septima Clark, Alexander Pushkin, Romia Bearden, Marva Collins, Mangalizo Subukwe, Julius Nyerere, and people who have made their contributions to our struggle in the field of education. And we have a play coming up on November 27th in remembrance of Kwame Nkrumah and Thomas Sankara, where our children will play both of them and pay tribute to them. And then in January of next year, we're opening the year with a play called Same Neighborhood, Different Perspectives, a conversation between General Colin Powell and Kwame Ture. And that's our way of dealing with this whole question of how the U.S. military has emerged as the second most decorated tradition in our community, second only to the church itself.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that. Dr. Richardson, I don't want to say 5, 10, 3, 2 years. I just want to start by asking you, where do you see PACAA in the future? What initiatives do you see this organization, you know, fully, you know, cultivating and sustaining in the future? And I, like I said, I won't, you know, I'll leave that up to you. I won't say, you know, 5 years, 10 years, 2 years, 3 years. But, you know, where do you see this organization, you know, resting itself? We're not going to ever rest. But where do you see it going in the future?
I think the potential for us to do, you know, very significant and progressive pioneering work is unlimited. And in the same fashion that we've seen other organizations that have started off with, you know, very well intended, but for various reasons have kind of lost their mission, and I'm thinking specifically about groups like the NAACP. But I think that we have the potential for what we plan to do and the things that need to be addressed, which we plan to attack in the near future, and whether that's internationally and on the continent or within inner city urban America. I wouldn't put a time limit on it, but I definitely feel, and I have to be quite honest, and it's rare that I felt this way, but I have just a really good, positive feeling about the things that are on the horizon for us. And I think that everybody on this line and as part of this group feels the same way. And I think we've all been in our respective kind of groups and organizations before this, and everyone has come to the table and kind of did their own self-evaluation and analysis of why they should be involved with this group. But I think that the synergy that we have, as OB had mentioned on the onset of this conversation, is just, to me, is unparalleled with any organization that I've been in. But I really just want to get involved in the work. I mean, now this is just the time to just really begin to get into the work and making our efforts to establishing policies and addressing policies and white papers and addressing issues that are on our home front, whether they exist in the Washington, D.C. area or whether they're in Zimbabwe. There's one issue, a couple that I know that we can address pretty much immediately, and it's one of the issues, and we kind of discussed this, you and I, Solomon, within the past week, is one of the issues is the building of the jail for youth in Baltimore. And right now, Governor O'Malley has had a moratorium to prevent the building of the jail, or at least they had tabled it at one point, but within the last month, they're now going forward with building a 120-bed jail for kids who are going to be charged as adults in Baltimore. And that prison will cost anywhere between $70 and $100 million. Now, we have on the ballot that we should have casinos in Prince George's County and what those casinos would offer to the bringing money to tax revenue and of revenue to the educational system, but we haven't begun to address why there's even a need. There's been numerous studies which have been evaluated, which have shown that there is absolutely no need to build a prison in Baltimore and use 70 to 100 million of taxpayers' dollars to build it. And actually, the city council for Baltimore, I think yesterday, had taken a stand in by a vote of 12 out of the 14 council members voting against it. But yet, the governor is still going to move ahead with it. So I think there are things right now, specifically dealing with the criminal justice system and criminal justice reform, which are in our backyard, that we can begin to kind of address immediately. And getting the word out, whether it's through having forums and panels and white papers, to bring attention to this issue, because it's not only going to, this is not only a national issue that's specific to Maryland, but a local issue specific to Maryland, but a national issue as well. So I envision that this organization will be sustainable well beyond any of us, and I hope that all of us live long, healthy, prosperous lives, but it exists well beyond our lives and will continue for generations on end.
That's right. I couldn't agree with you more, Dr. Richardson. I couldn't agree with you more, on all those accounts. And, you know, I see this organization, in very much the same light and you know, really cultivating and building it into an institution that, as you said, is that will far surpass, you know, our physical lives on planet Earth, because, you know, understanding that that these systems of oppression that adversely impact the lives of African people the globe over, and people of color the globe over, you know, they weren't built, you know, they necessarily in one person's lifetime. You know, it took generations and generations of white people that not just built these institutions, you know, whether it was slavery, whether it was like shadow slavery or neo-colonization or colonization itself, you know, on the continent. I mean, this was generation after generation after generation of Europeans that really put, you know, a lot of nefarious, evil time and effort into building these institutions of oppression. And that's why it's even more important that we as Africans, build institutions that are based around, you know, resistance, that are based around liberation, that are based around empowerment, that are built around, you know, nation building, you know, and the like, I can go on and on. And so I see this unique organization, the PACAA, and I will say it's very unique, and as I can't remember the last time that I've been a part of an effort with a finer team of individuals as you gentlemen. I really can't remember the last time. And this, you know, this is coming from someone who's played athletics his entire life and has always looked at it, you know, this far surpasses any of the delusions of grandeur I used to have as a kid, you know, to play professional athletics and being a part of some all-star teams and so forth. This takes the cake in every shape, form, or fashion. This is much bigger than entertainment. This is truly as life and, you know, life or death. And so that being... or life and death. And so, you know, that being said, I'd like to transition to Benjamin Woods.
Okay, yeah. I think, powerful. Like we mentioned, the potential of this is amazing. And I think, like you mentioned, just the political work that everybody here has done, the intellectual work that we've done, I mean, it shows the potential that we can do in just listening, I mean, to everybody who's spoken. I mean, you can really hear the potential, I mean, to have at the base, you know, the foundation of when you're starting to have a group of individuals this strong on the intellectual level and political, you know, which are intertwined, is rare. I mean, it just doesn't really happen very often. Like you all said, I don't think any organization I've been a part of has ever had this kind of foundation. And we have a strong foundation. The foundation is one of the strongest parts of anything you're building. And I think also, too, something I really we'd be remiss if we did not mention is our prisoners of war Someone that we in Students Against Mass Incarceration work with is Marshall Eddie Conway, someone who is was a member of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in Baltimore, Maryland, and has been incarcerated for 42 years. He went in as a father, and now he's a grandfather for a crime he didn't commit. No physics. Allegedly, he murdered a white police officer. Of course, there's no evidence, no forensic or physical evidence that connects him to a crime. They have a word of a jailhouse informant and some really circumstantial sort of eyewitness testimony from a police officer. And this man is sitting in jail for 42 years for something he didn't do. It wouldn't be the first. Of course, we know the story of Geronimo Pratt and many others who've gotten out. And, you know, right here in Maryland as well, we have somebody, Sundiata Akoli, another former Black Panther Party member. So these are sort of issues that just really, that really very rarely ever get touched, I think, by many of the liberal sort of civil rights groups. I mean, these people are rarely, are often left out of the discussion, and really shows the sort of radical tradition of the Black community that still exists and how it's being, you know, held back. But the potential of this group, I think, is amazing, and I just look forward to it. And what I see it is a lot of is growth, you know, people bringing in other people eventually, other intellectuals, other activists, and who can do work in connecting, you know, even across borders, you know. I mean, the Pan-African, like I said, Pan-African is in the name, so I think that's something that over the years, I think this has so much potential for growth, so I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you. Obi?
Well, I think that the things that I'm looking forward to, I mean, is basically, for the most part, the things that everybody has talked about. And in terms of the broader impact, I think that right now, one of the things that people are looking for is they're looking for an outlet to be able to express themselves on the front line. And I think that we've exhausted analysis by observation, observatory analysis. That's because there are two forms of analysis, analysis by participation and analysis by observation. And most of the analysis that people hear is from observation, and may I add, distant observation, sniper view, far away from the front line. And this is why you have what many people are treating like a social science, which is not. It's a, it's detrimental to social science. It's detrimental to history, to psychology, to philosophy, to sociology. Something called expertology, where you have people who try to position themselves to be experts, experts on hip-hop, experts on the criminal justice system, experts on Africa, experts on certain historical figures, experts on certain historical periods that are, we hold dear to heart as African people. So what this obviously does is it gives us the opportunity to be an alternative to that, where we're saying to pose as an expert is not only a masquerade, but it does nothing to intensify resistance in the areas that we've decided to confront as an organization. My whole political life, which is 23 years now, I've always been in organizations that had a Pan-African concentration and focus. My first one was the United Pan-African Front as a student in 1990, which then became the Pan-African Student Youth Movement. And then from there, I went into something called the Pan-African Liberation Organization. But your the organization that you're in should reflect your experience. It should reflect your understanding, and it should reflect your maturity. So what made this organization attractive to me is I knew that I could not organize in my 40s like I did in my 20s. There had to be a visible example of gradual progression, gradual enhancement. So that's what this organization had gave me. And I spent the last 3 years mainly working in my capacity as the U.S. correspondent to the Herald and in my capacity as a U.S.-based member of the Zimbabwe-Cuban Friendship Association, and I was waiting for the opportunity to be part of an organization inside United States borders that had a Pan-African focus, a Pan-African and international focus. So it would give us a chance to link up with Africans all over the world, but to look at creative things, projects, initiatives, and campaigns that will create the climate conducive for an organization like this to maximize its potential. And for many people who will listen to this, they must know that there's a political meaning to the word climate change. Climate change does not just deal with the weather. It doesn't deal with the environment. It deals with the social climate as well. It deals with the political climate as well. So I think that this organization right here can be a catalyst in changing the political climate and deal with the things that we are very dissatisfied with as a people and offer solutions to the multiple problems and challenges that we face as a people at this moment in history.
Thank you. And for my last question before we, in this exclusive special on Your World News launching the PACAA, I'd like to ask each one of you to just, usher out any, parting comments or thoughts that you have this is the official launch, and I know we have a press conference in the works, but for all intents and purposes, this is the first time that we have collectively come together publicly to announce, the launching of this this organization. I want to remind folks the website once again is www.thepacaa.org. That's thepacaa.org. And if you want more information, you can email us at pacaa@thepac.org. That's pacaa@thepac.org. You can reach all of us there. And so I just wanted to get your closing comments for this broadcast. And once again, we'll start with Dr. Joseph Richardson.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just think at again, just to reiterate what I said in the outset of our conversation, is that we're at a critical juncture right now, and there are a lot of people out there who are lost, who are misinformed, and there are a lot of people out there who are desperate to hear another narrative being provided, an alternative to what they're hearing right now. And as we know that with media consolidation and the lack of information, at least accurate information that people are getting, this is a necessary time for us to put our voice in that conversation. So, again, I think that we have a lot of work to do, and I don't want to sit here and add a rose-colored kind of tint-glass story to it as if, we don't have a lot of work ahead of us, because we definitely do. But I think we're all ready to take on that challenge, and I'm excited about it, and I'm ready to take on that challenge. I think it's a challenge that should have been addressed a long time ago, but there's no better time than the present, and I just look forward to all the work that we have in front of us to do.
Thank you. Ben?
Yeah, closing out, I think this is an important time for us. I mean, the potential, as I mentioned, is here, and just the time of, when you look at the world, I've mentioned so many things going on with Arab Spring to the so-called, the white left had their Occupy and the Spanish Indignados to what's going on in Americana and South Africa. I mean, this is a time of, I think, we're really seeing some possibilities for real change, and I think this is an important time, and the people who are coming together really show that, this can be really explosive and have a lot of potential to really make some waves in a long-term sense. And I think, like everybody said, offer an alternative, because I think, as everyone's, hinted at or said explicitly, is people are looking for something, but they need that vehicle. They need it there. And I think this is an opportunity. And so many issues, I mean, black people confronting around the world, we can offer an alternative, a way of perspective of seeing the world through our analysis of the information we have and through our action to mobilize.
Thank you, Ben. Obi?
Well, one of the things is the creation of this formation is timely, because when we look at the Pan-African sector of our movement, right now we are plagued by splits in Azania, South Africa. The Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania has many splits now. The All-African People's Revolutionary Party has many different splits now. The UNIA, ACL, has many different splits now. But what this organization is going to demonstrate is that a wounded animal is the most dangerous animal of all. So many people feel that on a Pan-African scale that we're wounded. And right now when you see so many people who have no history of doing work on the Pan-African scale attempting to impose their definition of Pan-Africanism on the rest of us, what this does is it challenges us to come up with activity that is Pan-African in scope, Pan-African in character, Pan-African in content, so that we can be an alternative to the masquerades and be able to rise above all, rise and deal and make the best contributions that we can make, because all organizations are, the best way to look at the quality of an organization is by the quality of contributions that it makes. So that's what we plan to do. We plan to bring clarity to many different things, but at the same time, through the contributions we make, because your work truly defines who you are.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I think, and you know, I really don't have you know, much more to contribute in terms of you know, closing comments beyond what you brother said. I just it's been a long time coming, as Dr. Richardson alluded, and I think we've all shared this, you know, in private dialogue, that it's been a long time coming, and we've been working on this for a year diligently, and I like I said, I feel very confident moving forward, and to be with individuals like yourselves that are not just strong, you know, activists, strong Africans, but you're consistent, and it's consistency that's what's going to ride us into the future. That's what's going to allow us to really grow and positively metastasize this organization in a positive way that births life and liberation and empowerment and a lot of you know, positive change that our people are in desperate need of right now, quite frankly. You know, where there's a global attack on African people and people of color in general, you know. To say the least, the mental attack, the attack on our psyches has been one of the most consistent and ceaseless attacks, and I think this organization, because of the work that we're going to do, the work that we're going to do is going to speak for itself, and it's going to, you know, beyond the work that we're doing in the communities, it's going to allow us to really regain the psyche of a lot of individuals in our communities, and to see what, you know, what African liberation looks like and what kind of work it requires. And especially in this era of Obama, you know, and white liberalism and the Trojan horse that they've created with President Barack Obama and sneaking that Trojan horse into our community. Well, I guess you could say the Democratic Party was already, you know, so let me cancel that out, you know. But as Obi has said, you know, time and time again, it wasn't the fact that Barack Obama was a brown-skinned man that so many black folks have just blindly supported and continue to support him. It's the combination of him being a brown-faced man and a Democrat, and I couldn't agree with Obi's analysis on that anymore. So the PACAA has a lot of work ahead of itself, but this core group of individuals is more than prepared for that work, and we've been putting in that work, and I look forward to it, and look forward to continuous this dialogue and work as we go in the future. So, gentlemen, I thank you for your time. You know, the past 80 something minutes on this Friday evening, October 26, 2012, and as I said before, people, you know the website now. It's www.thepacaa.org. Please visit us, visit it. You know, peruse the website. The appeal is already posted there, as well as some other articles that will continue to be of interest to you, as well as the white papers that Dr. Richardson alluded to that we're going to be posting there, as well as a range of things, cultural, systemic, and otherwise. So thanks again, and with that being said, I will bid us, you know, farewell for the evening, and let us be taken out by the Your World News theme music.
Thank you.
No problem.
All right.
So thanks, for Your World News, but more importantly for the PACAA and Dr. Joseph Richardson, Benjamin Woods, and Obi Aguna, all three are my brothers. I'm Solomon Kamajan, and this is the PACAA, and this is the official media wing for the PACAA, Your World News.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
turn, I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker upmade me out of self-righteous hatred, and now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix, a suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years, they're prejudiced. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.